This is an ABC podcast.
Good morning, this is Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia. I'm Richard Ewart. So coming up, stranded in Australia, another group of sailors from Kiribati caught up in the pandemic and unable to make the trip home. Historic changes voted through by the World Rugby Council that means star players with Pacific heritage captured by the likes of New Zealand and Australia will be able to play for their countries of origin after a three-year stand-down. And a delayed budget is expected to be handed down in Papua New Guinea today, despite government payment systems being thrown into chaos by cyber hackers.
It's deeply concerning because unaddressed cyber risk still exists. Just because you claim you've gone back to normal doesn't mean you have, right? Yeah, so there's a gap.
More on PNG's budget problems to come a little later in the program. We start, though, in Solomon Islands, where residents of the capital, Honiara, have been ordered into a 36-hour lockdown following anti-government protests and looting. A prominent high school and factory were set on fire by looters overnight, but despite these incidents, much of the city has remained calm, with a high police presence across the capital. Tensions came to a head yesterday when protesters calling for Prime Minister Manasseh Sogavare to step down breached the parliamentary complex and set fire to a traditional leaf hut. Police were able to disperse the crowd using tear gas and rubber bullets and push them out of the city centre. Several buildings were stoned and a police station in a Honiara suburb was also set alight. The protesters are believed to be supporters of the Malaita provincial government, which has had a long-running rift with the Sogavare administration over its decision to switch diplomatic ties from Taiwan to China. Keeping an eye on events for us in Honiara, our man Evan Wasuka. Evan, good morning to you.
Good morning, Richard.
So tell us more about what the situation was like overnight and exactly how people are feeling today. Now they're facing a 36-hour lockdown.
That's right, Richard. I think everyone's just waking up to the fact that they have to spend the next day or so locked up at home, and just a disruption to lives. Kids can't go to school. So I think that's what people are getting their heads around this morning. I'm sure people are also thankful that there were no fatalities or major damage in the looting we saw yesterday and overnight. So last night we saw that there were a building was burnt, and it was a bit puzzling that a school was set on fire. That's different from what you've seen in the past. I'm sure people are trying to figure out what to do over the next day or so. But according to the Prime Minister, Manasseh Sogavare, the lockdown is aimed at preventing further rioting and gives investigators time to find out who are behind the riots and the protest. This is Prime Minister Manasseh Sogavare speaking last night when he gave a national address about the lockdown.
Your government is in place and continues to lead our nation. I assure all the law-abiding citizens of our beloved country that the government's investigative arm is already at an advanced stage of tracking all the people that were behind today's events in Honiara. I assure you all that the people responsible for today's events, which led to the destruction of properties, will be taken to justice and they will face the full brunt of the law.
Prime Minister Manasseh Sogavare there, Evan, and now the dust has settled. I mean, do you get the sense that the worst is over?
Well, I think the feeling everyone is starting to get this morning. The curfew overnight has really done its job. It's slowed things down. I mean, even yesterday in the evening before the curfew was announced, I was down in the eastern part of the city and there were still people, large groups milling around, and there was always the potential for things to escalate. The interesting thing about the lockdown is that it's actually being imposed as part of the COVID-19 emergency laws, which give the Prime Minister the ability to announce a lockdown if there's a COVID-19 outbreak. So there's been some questions raised on social media about whether this is the proper thing to do, if the law is being used properly. But then there's also other concerns that this lockdown came in so sudden that people have been caught without the ability to have collect food and be prepared on what to do over the next 2 days or so. Dr. Transform Angarao, he's a prominent political commentator. He's calling on the government to rethink this lockdown because people especially mothers and children, probably don't have enough food with them to last the distance of the lockdown. And when the announcement came, it also caught people unaware. That included some students at the University of South Pacific, and ABC spoke to one of them, Maverick Patrick Seda, and this is what he had to say.
We're stuck in our university campus, you know, because of the lockdown. Some of us are depressed, stressed, and, you know, freaking out. We're not prepared for the lockdown, so, you know, it will be a 36-hour lockdown. We were supposed to, you know, go back to their homes, and because of the lockdown, we have to, you know, because of the protest, we have to stuck in our university and, you know, wait until Friday morning. And some of us here, fully stocked with food and other things.
So a reaction from the University of South Pacific, just one of the students caught up in this snap lockdown. I mean, what about the wider reaction to what's happened, Evan? What's been happening on the international front?
PNG Prime Minister James Marape, he's calling on Solomon Islanders to follow the rule of law, and he said he's spoken to the Prime Minister, Manase Sogavare. That's interesting that they had a conversation so soon after the incident happened. Otherwise, we haven't seen anything yet come from the wider international community. The ABC has heard that DFAT is the Department of Foreign Affairs, the Australian government, is on standby waiting for a request of assistance from the Solomons. That hasn't yet happened, so we'll see how that things play out in the coming day.
And I guess inevitably the geopolitical situation may crop up. A link to what's happened here. I mean, is the China-Taiwan debate and Malaita's attitude to Solomon's shift to China in any way responsible for what's happened?
Well, I think partly is probably the answer to that question, Richard, because this whole situation between the Malaita provincial government and the national government has been about the switch over from Taiwan, from Taiwan to China, and that's been part of the rift between the two groups. And the original protests yesterday were based from Malaitan province, people coming over to march and to demand that Sogavare step down. But then things went out of hand, and we've seen, as we've seen in the past, incidents, opportunists come in and looting happen. So some part of it was stemmed from that situation between the national government and the provincial government.
Evan, we'll leave it there. Thank you very much indeed for that update after 24 hours or so of serious disturbances, really, in the capital, Solomon Islands, at Honiara, and they're now into a 36-hour lockdown to try and maintain the current state of calm. We will, of course, keep you posted here on Pacific Beat.
Pacific Beat.
Richard Hewitt with you for a Thursday morning, and as around 150 sailors from Kiribati who have been stranded in Fiji for months have finally set sail for home, the ABC can confirm that another group of Kiribati mariners are stuck here in Australia. As Dubravka Valdez reports, they have been prevented from going home since the COVID-19 pandemic began because, quite simply, the Kiribati government has kept its borders very firmly shut to prevent coronavirus getting in.
Barente Take Taunea is a sailor from Kiribati who's been stranded in Brisbane since May, but he's not been home for about 2 years.
Some of the crew, they've been on the ship for 18 months. After 18 months, they were here again in the hotel here in Brisbane for another 6 months already now.
He's one of 38 sailors who are currently calling Brisbane home while they wait to eventually return to their families in Kiribati.
We've been very stressed and depressed because due to this COVID, and it's being hard to get home soon, and then without work, and we've been so worried that we don't have we cannot support anymore our families with financial support. That's been a big problem with us.
They, like many Kiribati sailors, had been working on board cargo ships overseas. But they were stranded when COVID-19 struck and their government closed off its borders to prevent the virus from getting in. Helen Turner is the centre supervisor for the Mission of Seafarers in Brisbane, which has been supporting the men.
Initially, there was a seafarer who contacted me via Facebook and actually wanted to order some car parts, which is how I actually found out that they were actually staying in a hotel, because we hadn't been notified until then. So his name is Roque, and he's only a young man. He has a son who is 4, and it's been over two years since he's seen his family, which to me is just tragic.
The mission organised phone SIMs and recharge cards for the sailors so they can be in touch with loved ones at home.
The whole crew, yeah, they always connect with their families, and this is the problem. They always say, we still have kids, and then how can we support our kids in school?
It's understood that the Danish shipping company Maersk was one of the main employers of the Kiribati sailors. A statement released this week by the NGO Human Rights at Sea claims that Maersk has tried to negotiate for the men to return home, but that the Kiribati government has been reluctant to repatriate the seafarers directly from Australia to Kiribati. It says the government is only prepared to talk about transporting the seafarers from Fiji to Kiribati and is in talks with a cruise line. The statement goes on to quote Maersk as saying,
"While we do not find this solution optimal and would prefer to repatriate our seafarers by plane both from Fiji and Australia, we have offered to cover the cost of this cruise vessel together with other shipping companies employing seafarers from Kiribati to secure our seafarers stranded in Brisbane and ensure they're reunited with their families as soon as possible. We will have to repatriate this group of seafarers via Fiji."
The ABC has contacted the Kiribati President's office for comment. While here, the men have still been receiving part of their wages, as well as food and accommodation paid for by their employer. But Mr. Taunea says that once they are in Fiji, the wage payment will stop.
Once we get into Fiji, to Nandi, everything will be stopped from our company. Our normal basic wage that we always received right here in Brisbane, it will be all cut, because we cannot get any more basic wage once we get into Fiji. Our crew here, they all feel worried, that they say, how can we support our family once we stay again in Fiji, because we will not receive any basic wage once we get into Fiji. This is a big problem for our crew, and they're always worried how to support their families who are staying back in Kiribati.
He says he's been told that they could head to Fiji in early December. But they don't want to go because it means that they won't be able to support their families back home. And so they're exploring other options, including staying on in Australia to find work as fruit pickers. Those close to the men are worried about their welfare. And Helen Turner from the Seafarers Mission says they've tried to keep their morale up.
We're able to organise a couple of the mini buses that we have to take the seafarers out to wherever they're going. They love to sing and dance, and the Kiribati communities prepare, you know, the normal sort of food that they would have at home. Initially we were bringing them out to the mission at least once a week and giving them like an Aussie barbecue, which of course for them is a little bit foreign.
Volunteers are also helping, including Patrick Quirk, a former general manager of maritime safety in Queensland.
I don't want them to live in a prison, so as much as we can, we try to provide them with outings and things different to keep their interest up, because some of them haven't been home for over 18 months. Some of them had babies they haven't seen yet, so it's important that we keep their morale and well-being up.
The Kiribati community in Brisbane is also helping, cooking them homemade food and inviting them into their homes. Juanita Limpus is one of them.
Just to boost their morales, we're just sort of like, it's really hard when you're depressed. I mean, that's going to be another worry. So that's just sort of just take them out, you know, just share our homes with them. You know, we take them out, we have some picnics, you know, cook them their food that they're used to from home.
But Helen Turner from the Seafarers Mission says she does not understand why the man had to wait so long to get home.
All of the seafarers are double vaccinated, so all of that is done. None of them are COVID positive. They're all basically like we are in Brisbane. You know, we're allowed to go out to the shops and so are these boys.
It's understood that other sailors from Kiribati are still stranded in Germany, Indonesia and South Korea, waiting to get home.
That report from Dubravko Volodare here on Pacific Beat. Now, and what will come as a surprise to many in the rugby world, the World Rugby Council has at last voted in favour of changing international eligibility rules. That means star names like the Tongan duo of Charles Peartau and Nani Lamape are now free to play for their country of heritage after they complete a three-year stand-down. It means Peartau, the first million-pound player in English club rugby, will be free to play for the Akalitahi immediately, as he last played for the All Blacks back in 2012. More broadly, the change will open the door for other players capped by the likes of New Zealand and Australia, but with Tongan and Samoan heritage, to make the switch if called upon. It's a move that many in the game, particularly in the Pacific, believe will allow the island nations to feel stronger, more competitive sides, and have a bigger impact on future World Cups. After the vote, World Rugby Vice Chairman Bernard Laporte said they had listened to their membership and honoured their pledge to undertake wide-ranging review of this important regulation. He went on to say, "We have consulted, sought feedback from our unions, regions and most importantly, players' representatives before making a recommendation to the council." We're joined now by Richard Sapias, who's president of Oceania Rugby. He joins us from Papua New Guinea. Richard, good morning to you.
Good morning, Richard.
So, I guess you must be surprised. I mean, this has been asked for years and years by people in the Pacific. Finally, you've got it, but I guess you must have been holding your breath.
Yeah, absolutely elated. You know, they were sort of quiet claps and that. You couldn't be too noisy on the big Zoom call last night. But yeah, absolutely fantastic result. And as you said, it has been pushed a couple of times in the past, and unfortunately, without success.
Now, my question to you would therefore be that 75% of the vote was required. A number of nations have dug their heels in over this for a long, long time now. What has persuaded them finally to change their minds?
I think there is a sort of bit of a tide of change. World Rugby, to be fair, I need to take my hat off and just to thank World Rugby for there was a tremendous amount of work done in the background, I think, and that sort of engagement helped allowed for that important conversation to get the other stakeholders to understand what the cost of not having a change like this means for the game long term. So I think that there was a great narrative in the lead up. There was a lot of consultation, as you've mentioned, and I think that helped to sort of change some attitudes.
And when it actually came down to the vote, I mean, was it just the 75%, or was it nearly nearly unanimous?
Yeah, good question, Richard. I mean, look, in the end, I'll be honest with you, it was about 76% in the end. So we actually just crept across the line. There was still a number who weren't for the change, and there was a number who did abstain. But in the end, we just got over the line, and I think the old cliche that every vote counts really came through last night.
So just clearly is good enough. This is now there. It will now unfold. The likes of Charles Peartau can come back and play for their nations of heritage. I mean, what do you think this is going to be on Pacific Island rugby, particularly for Tonga and Samoa? I mean, Fiji insists that they're not bothered. They've got the players anyway. But I wouldn't be surprised if one or two of them maybe were called back if they felt it was necessary.
Yeah, look, absolutely. I think it's important, as you say, very broadly. Look, it certainly helps to compensate for the gap in the decision. It's not the total solution, obviously, for standards for emerging nations, but it's a great benefit to the emerging nations, and that obviously can't be underestimated how good the result is. And I think, as you say, look, domestically, obviously, programs still need to come through to produce good players, but it supports the likes of Tonga and Samoa in the Pacific, who have really been probably at the brunt of having a lot of their good players captured by the likes of Australia and New Zealand, and certainly now more broadly with other nations around the world. They stand to benefit almost immediately.
And in terms of future investment and growing the game in countries like Tonga and Samoa, I mean, an Akalitahi side with Charles Peartau in it is a much more attractive proposition, I would have thought, to would-be sponsors than a team without him.
Absolutely. And look, the old adage, everyone loves to back a winning team. I think that's key, and that in these sorts of conversations. I mean, it doesn't matter which sport you're following, but you want to see your team win, and lopsided scorelines don't help. They don't certainly don't help sponsorship and even having the interest back home. I mean, the other thing too, as you're well aware too, Richard, is that as a sport, it's a product where we're competing against the likes of rugby league, which is very strong in the Pacific, and we are losing players to that code as well. So I think it's important that we're giving our nations, our membership, the best opportunity for them to attract or I suppose in some respects recover some of the players that they want to.
Now, of course, Bill Beaumont, as chairman of World Rugby, when he was re-elected in somewhat controversial circumstances, it has to be said. But, I mean, he promised this review, which he delivered. But I think it's fair to say that sceptics in the Pacific thought that's all you would get, a review, not necessarily a change. So the fact that this change has come through now, does that give you more confidence in Bill Beaumont's leadership?
Yeah, it does. I think, as I said, I think at the end of the day, as I said, the past, there was obviously a vote. There was two different schools of thought. It does, to answer your question, it does give more confidence. Bill's been very engaging, and I have to be fair to him, to the chairman. He's been very engaged since he's been re-elected. And I've seen a lot more dialogue with him, even personally. So I feel that he's genuinely what was pushing. And as I said, this is, at the start of a process of a number of things we want to see happening. But we're certainly very grateful.
And does this bode well more broadly for developing the game in the Pacific in the future in other ways? I mean, there's been talk, for example, that maybe Fiji is the number one ranked team in the Pacific at the moment, might be included in something like the Six Nations Championship, but in the Southern Hemisphere with Australia, New Zealand, Argentina and others. I mean, can you see that happening now?
Look, at a stretch, I'd be hard for me to comment on where that I can see happening, to answer your question. But I think, as I said, I think what some important points here, Rich, is that it certainly brings the standard up without sort of overstaying the points with Tonga and Samoa. But the other thing, too, to remember is that you do have other emerging nations which would change the game as well, too. And if I took a sort of broader conversation with World Rugby, you look at nations even within Europe, who've got players who may have been captured by the likes of France or England, etc., such as, Portugal and Romania does pretty well. But even some of these players, would have the opportunity to return to their respective nations. And there were conversations about that. So that helps to grow the game within the Pacific, more closely to home for all of us. The likes of, as an example, Cook Islands, who have a tremendous amount of players who play in New Zealand. You can imagine the effect that would have. Other emerging nations, who are really trying to get, some of their players back home to influence the codes, who may not be as strong back home, even within PNG, the likes of having opportunities like the Wilgenias, etc. So you've got, to me, this changes, the conversation, the landscape in terms of what these players can bring back to their countries of birth.
Talking of Wilgenia, I mean, does this make you contemplate what the impact might have been on rugby union in Papua New Guinea if he'd been available to come back, if this change had been made earlier?
Yes and no. I mean, I think there's no doubt that he does bring tremendous changes. A lot of work, as I said, it's not the total solution, but it certainly takes us to a different conversation. Obviously, all the unions have to still get, their programs in order and make sure they've got programs which are sustainable for their programs going forward and for the future. But it certainly would be a massive game changer. I mean, he's a very high profile player, played obviously for the Wallabies, and it certainly would have influenced had he been available earlier, no doubt.
I was reading an article in the Australian Press a couple of weeks ago where it was talking about rugby union is not going to get its Tamalolo moment. And what that means, of course, is the reference to Jason Tamalolo switching sides to play rugby league for Tonga and looking at what happened to them when they went to the last World Cup. But now we have the Tamalolo moment. We have the Piatau moment. I mean, can you see Tonga really making great strides at the World Cup there in 2023 with the sort of side they can put out?
Yeah, I do. I think that it changes a lot of their, in terms of decisions. It gives them a wider range of opportunities. Their players, as I said, they've got a tremendous amount of players. For a country, the nation the size of Tonga, which is 40,000-50,000, and you imagine about the amount of players that they have overseas, players playing out throughout the world. There's a lot of talent out there, and it gives them a wide range of opportunities to choose from. So.
It's going to be fascinating to see how it all plays. They've been asking for it for a long time in the Pacific. Finally, World Rugby have delivered. Richard, thank you so much for joining us on Pacific Beat this morning. We appreciate your time.
Thank you, Richard.
Richard Sapias there, president of Oceania Rugby. They put their two votes into the pot and just got over the line. They needed 75%. They got 76%. So the change is now on the books, as it were. Charles Beattau, we presume, will be playing for Tonga in the near future, and other players will be coming back as well. It's exciting news for rugby union in the Pacific. Now, time to take a look at what the weather has in store for us across the region today. The forecast for Thursday, starting in the PNG capital, Port Moresby, where a mostly clear day is on the cards with a high of 32 degrees Celsius. Over in Suva, a high of 29 degrees Celsius expected on a cloudy day with some showers, isolated thunderstorms and isolated heavy falls. And that's the broad picture across the rest of Fiji too. A day of light rain or showers in Vanuatu, with temperatures climbing to 32 degrees Celsius in Port Vila and a touch lower at 31 in Luganville. Fine, apart from a few showers in Solomon Islands and some provinces, can expect thunderstorms. Top temperature in the capital, Honiara, at 31 degrees Celsius. The picture for Samoa is one of cloudy periods with scattered showers. Moderate falls and thunderstorms are also possible. And the temperature in the capital, Apia, will reach 30 degrees Celsius. And in Tonga, partly cloudy right across the country with a few showers likely on the highest of the islands at Niuatoputapu, and in the capital, Nuku'alofa. The high temperature there will be around 30 degrees Celsius. Now, the budget is meant to be handed down in Papua New Guinea today after a delay prompted by government struggles with offline payment systems, which were targeted by a devastating cyber attack. In October, ransomware hackers froze the system that controls access to millions of dollars used to pay bills, salaries and make loan repayments. As Mackenzie Smith reports, PNG's government has refused to pay any ransom money, instead has been relying on checks to complete financial transfers.
With COVID-19 cases continuing to surge across PNG, this week's budget will be critical for paving a way forward through the crisis. But it's already been set back by another kind of virus, with the government blaming October's cyber attack for a delay to the budget lockup planned for earlier this week. Maholopa Lavale, a lecturer in economics at the University of Papua New Guinea, says the problems extend far beyond a delayed budget.
We're hearing reports from subnational governments, provincial governments that aren't receiving operational funds for their day-to-day operations, which means that they've had to scale back non-essential services. And this has become a concern.
Among them, the governor of East Sepik province, Ellen Bird, who told the ABC they haven't been able to pay any of their suppliers in the 7 weeks since the cyber attack. Mr. Lavale says time is running out to strengthen PNG's payment systems.
PNG is vulnerable to another surge in COVID cases. The model suggests that it'll be in March of 2022. And health expenditure, particularly health funds to subnational governments, is very important. If the IFMS system continues to be vulnerable and is attacked at a time when we're experiencing another surge, it'll affect PNG's ability to mitigate the next surge. So addressing the vulnerabilities and accepting all the help from donors is very important.
He says if these issues aren't addressed, it could worsen the COVID-19 crisis.
The government should put aside a part of next year's budget to addressing these vulnerabilities. I mean, it's already tried to restore the system, but to ensure that an attack like this does not happen. And government has to pay attention to a lot of the advice that it received from experts within country. For example, a Deloitte expert pointed these vulnerabilities early 2020, and if government had heeded this warning, it wouldn't be in this problem right now.
PNG's government has released little detail on the ransomware attack, including what's been demanded. But more than a month on, payments are still being processed offline. The former general manager of PNG's National Cybersecurity Centre, Robert Potter, says so far the government appears to be ignoring its problems.
It's deeply concerning because unaddressed cyber risk still exists. Just because you claim you've gone back to normal doesn't mean you have, right? Yeah, so there's a gap.
Mr. Potter says the cyber attack could also impact the electoral system, given how reliant politicians are on development funds to win votes. And PNG is set to have its national election next year.
It's really important to be able to pay people in PNG. That is the most important payment gateway in the country. So there's a lot of unanswered questions about, you know, what's going on and the extent of the damage. And there's a lot of unprecedented things that are happening. In as much as I'm not aware of of a similar incident where a country has been knocked off or affected so heavily by a single ransomware attack.
Mr. Potter says PNG needs to accept help from international partners.
Without external expertise, it's probably going to be very difficult. Certainly Australia has offered, as has the United States. There's been multiple offers from multiple partners to PNG government of assistance of whatever they need. But so far, they haven't engaged any external assistance that try them managing it internally.
Unless help is taken up, the problems of an offline payment system show no sign of abating. One provincial government official told the ABC they've been advised that their usual systems might not be back online until April.
A report from Mackenzie Smith. With the Thursday morning edition of Pacific Beat with me, Richard Ewart. Now, living here in Australia, teenager Logan Tapula was feeling somewhat disconnected from his Samoan heritage. That was until he started learning fire knife dancing, known as Siva Afi. Now, he teaches Siva Afi all around the world through online workshops. Produced by Mark Arden and Jacqueline Howard, this is Logan's story.
Over 1,000 years ago, my Samoan ancestors would come back from war and recreate battles for the village. They would spin, throw, and catch their Nifo Oti war clubs. Time passed, fire was added to the blades, and it became Siva Afi, the fire knife dance. I was born in Melbourne, but lived on the beautiful islands of Samoa when I was younger. I loved it there, going to the beach, spending time with family, and eating delicious Samoan food. But when we moved back to Melbourne, I found it really hard to adjust. I began losing my Samoan language, eating junk food, and just gaming way too much. I felt disconnected. Like something was missing, and I didn't know who I was. To help, Mum took me to Samoan school, and I signed up for Siva Afi. That workshop changed my life. I started training daily in the backyard. I saved up my pocket money, and with Mum's blessing, bought myself some proper fire knife sticks.
So, this is the Nifo Oti. In English, Nifo means tooth, and Oti means death, the tooth of death.
I not only perform at events and celebrations, but teach students around the world with my online workshops. Today, I'm teaching students from Hawaii. I want this knowledge to be available to all Samoans and anyone wanting to build their confidence, discipline, and feel a connection to the Samoan culture. Siva Afi has enabled me to be confident in my identity as a Samoan Australian. I no longer wonder who I am, and I hope I can help people be proud of who they are.
Teenager Logan Tapula and his story, produced there by Mark Iden and Jacqueline Howard. Now for our regular Thursday morning feature, Call of the Wild, and earlier this month the people of Waitambu in Fiji marked the arrival of the nunga, or the spinefoot rabbit fish, with a traditional harvest. Thousands of nunga were collected during the event, which marked the first significant harvest since 2004, in fact. Helen Sykes is a marine scientist based in Fiji. She's very familiar with the Waitambo community. She joins us on the line now from Fiji to chat more about this special event. Helen, good morning to you. Welcome to Pacific Beat.
Oh, Bula Vinaka, and thank you very much for having me.
So this was quite an affair by the sound of it. There's been no significant harvest since 2004. That's, what, 17 years ago. So I imagine the community was buzzing, wasn't it?
Oh, they were very excited about it. And the interesting thing really is that they definitely tie this into significant community events. And one of the sons of the village was actually part of the Fiji Rugby Olympic team that won the gold medal this year. So I think there's going to be a lot of association with that.
So double cause for celebration. Now, to get to the basics of it, where, I mean, tell us more about this particular fish and why it's so special to the people of Waitambu.
So in Fiji, we have a system of what in colonial times was translated as totems, but in Fiji is known as itsavuti, which is basically three special things for each particular tribe or matangali within a village. So they will normally have some kind of fish, they'll have some kind of plant, and they'll have some kind of tree that is very special to each particular clan. And in Taviuni, it is the Nunga rabbit fish. So the basic biology here is that the rabbit fish is a reef fish that feeds mostly in seagrass beds. And like most fish, they spawn out in the deep ocean, and the larval fish, the tiny, tiny fish, will swim around in the outside ocean for months sometimes until they find suitable habitat. When they come into the reef, they are maybe 2 centimeters long, perhaps up to 5, and they come in large amounts. And those who find a good habitat will win and will get to live there. So this is the incoming of this fish. And when it happens, it looks like the whole water is black, as though there were tiny, well, there are tiny, tiny fish, like a big shadow all over it. And so traditionally, the senior women of the village have the right to go out there and catch these. So it's not everybody can go. It's the senior ladies who will go out in their best dresses and net these fish. And so it's a significant event for them because it signifies community happiness and collective thinking. But it's also a significant event marine science-wise because it means that they have healthy habitat for these small fish to actually come and be in.
Now, my understanding is that during the course of the ceremony, thousands of fish will be collected in the way that you've just described there. I mean, I'm presuming that isn't going to have an impact on sustainability, this one-off event, or is it?
No, it's not, because a lot of these fish would not find habitat there anyway. Only some will be successful, and the rest basically turns into food for other animals. So when you have these settlement events, you will have quite a low percentage that actually settles to become adults, and the rest are just basically part of the gamble that the fish takes by just spawning in enormous amounts. So this is one of the few events that we would say is absolutely fine. It cannot be overfished, not at the level they're doing it at any rate.
And Waitambu is part of a marine reserve in Fiji, as I understand it, and there's been a lot of debate at the moment about what's happening in Kiribati and them opening up the Phoenix Island protected area to commercial fishing. I mean, that's a huge marine reserve. I presume here in Fiji we're not talking about something on quite that scale, but nevertheless, these reserves are vitally important, aren't they, to the marine ecosystem?
They really are. And we have a system in Fiji which is called FLAMA, which is the Fiji Locally Managed Marine Areas Network. They operate in other countries as well. The Fiji one is obviously ours. And we have over 400 small village communities in Fiji that have small marine protected areas under their own control. And they are specifically for fisheries management, that they will provide havens for breeding and for regeneration of corals that will then go out and restock the areas where they fish. So this is not a government type of project. This is a grassroots project. So this is agreed to by the people of the village community and within the surrounding villages. And it's based on a traditional system in Fiji called tambu, or taboo, if you were putting it in perhaps Hawaiian terms, but tambu here, where the people of the village can declare a part of their own fishing grounds, or Ngolingoli, as no fishing areas. And it doesn't require government input at all. And they will police it. But out in these outer islands, it's just agreed to by all the communities, and then they obey it. So at the moment, there's no sort of threat to commercial fishing from these small marine protected areas.
It's interesting that the question of control seems to be very much in the hands of the community. I mean, they are the people, after all, that will know best about how the marine life functions in their part of Fiji. And I'm assuming this is, as a successful model, one that could be repeated elsewhere in the Pacific. I guess probably already is being repeated elsewhere in the Pacific. But it's very different from, as you say, the government setup.
Yes, it really is. And this is what we call community-based adaptive management. So we start off with a request from the communities that they want to improve their fishing resources and their marine life out the front of their villages. And then we go in as scientists and talk with them, and we find out from their knowledge where would be best places to protect, where would be the best time of year to protect. We then give them a management plan, which we execute but it's totally run by the community. And then we do annual monitoring where we can feed back to them if there is anything that probably should be changed. But the decisions are made at the community level. This is used in other places in the South Pacific, but it's particularly strong in Fiji because of the traditional usage of the Ngolingoli. So this is the fishing grounds that front the land that each village traditionally owns, which is known as the Vanua. And so the owners of the Vanua have the fishing rights, and therefore they have the ability to control this. This is not true in all of the rest of the Pacific.
And presumably that kind of activity, that kind of local control is going to become ever more important in the face of climate change.
Absolutely. These little reserves also form little havens of biological improvement. They're not large areas. They're maybe a kilometre long, so it's not a huge ecosystem that's being protected. But it's fisheries management. It gets the people understanding the point of conservation, and it gives them a real incentive to do it. So it is, the idea is the usage of these traditional things. And when we get something like a Nunga settlement event, it really helps to strengthen this. The Waitambu Marine Park was formed in 1998, and there was a little bit of dispute. It takes time for everybody to agree that this is a good thing. And so there hadn't been Nunga since the 1960s. And then in 2004, when the project had been actually working and we were starting to get a recovery of the ecosystem there, suddenly the Nunga came back, and that was a massive event for them. And it was the first time that the chief of this particular area had had the Nunga presented to him since 1960s. So it was very deeply felt, and I hope that this event will be very deeply felt as well. It is a sign that the community is working together.
It's good to know. It's good to see. And I'm sure it was quite an event, especially with that addition of the rugby gold medal from the Olympics thrown into the mix. Helen, we'll have to leave it there. Thank you so much for talking to us on Pacific Beat this morning. We really appreciate your time.
You're very welcome. Goodbye. Thank you.
Helen Sykes, marine scientist based in Fiji, talking about the festival in Waitambu, the traditional harvest of the spinefoot rabbit fish, or the Nunga. And rounding out this edition of Pacific Beat here on ABC Radio Australia, Jordan Fennell will be along with the afternoon edition at 3:05 PNG time this afternoon. And I'll be back with the final edition of the week, as far as the morning is concerned, at 6:05 PNG time tomorrow morning. Hope you can join me then. In the meantime, enjoy your Thursday.